you know, having her around, it's been so fun to like just pick up the guitar and like make up songs with her, which is something that I wouldn't have done on my own. I think like playing instruments has definitely been a bigger part of my day as a result. And it's so nice just to like feel, you know, inspired to do that. Even if it's just, you know, making up dumb nonsense, at least we're doing something creative and fun together.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with DJ, musician, and entrepreneur Matt Rohn. As a DJ, Matt has played all over the world from Miami to Milan and performed at Lollapalooza twice. As a musician, he's helped record numerous records with bands Written in the Sand, Innkeepers, the 1900s, and Pixel and the Silver Sphinx. As an entrepreneur and business owner, he and his longtime friend Emilio Abadia, aka E6, co-founded Crossfader King and have helped countless young DJs get their start. Today, Matt continues to move dance floors at his Chicago residencies, as well as entertaining the masses at corporate and private events. Last year alone, he worked with the likes of the Waldorf Astoria, Major League Soccer, the Chicago Blackhawks, Gucci, Moet, and the list goes on and on. Matt is dad to his 3.5-year-old daughter. In this episode, Matt details his journey from basement bands to dive bar DJ to nightlife entrepreneur. He shares how and why music makes him more empathic and emotionally connected to his daughter, why he only plays house and disco at home, and how he and his wife make their dual entrepreneur household work. For most of these interviews, I've started at the beginning with people's own origin stories and relationships to their own fathers or father figures they had growing up. So sure. I'd love for you to tell me about your dad.
Oh my God. Dan Rohn, Chicago's very own, is truly a hero. One of the best people on the planet. Love him very, very much. I'm getting emotional already. I was out late last night and I did not sleep very much and I'm feeling it right now. I'm like, oh man, I got to talk about Diesel. We call him around the house. He's the best. He's a guy who grew up on the Mississippi River in Keokuk, Iowa with his two brothers and his mom and dad. And he came from not a whole lot, but he was an exceptional athlete and he ended up getting a full golf scholarship to Illinois State. And that's where he found broadcasting and, you know, his love of sports and his love of writing kind of molded into this career that he's had now for the last 30 plus years over at WGN. And my childhood was kind of atypical in the sense that, you know, we didn't see him at night because he's on the news at 9 o'clock. We would hang out in the morning. And oftentimes he would stay and pick us up from lunch so that we could hang out, you know, for that hour during elementary school time. And then we really would get to hang out on Fridays and Saturdays. But, you know, he was always around as much as his schedule allowed him to be. And our childhood was, you couldn't really ask for a whole lot more. I'm a very spoiled person when it comes to having been great places, seen great things. I mean, especially him coming up during the Bulls dynasty. And, you know, he's seen a lot of wild sports moments. And we've been lucky to be a part of some of those because, you know, he's been able to take us along for the ride. So he's also just a really sweet and caring and supportive human being. You know, I remember sitting down with my parents when I was trying to figure out this whole DJ thing. And I had made the decision to quit my day job. And I was like, yeah, so I'm going to quit my job and DJ full time. And they were like, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean? And I was like, listen, here's where I'm at. Here are the financials. Like, I'm trying to make this thing go. And they basically were like, hey, man, it's your world. It's your life. We wish you the best. Like, go ahead and do it. So, you know, they also were the people that let us have band practice in their basement for probably a decade. My idiot friends from junior high and high school and even down into college would come back to the suburbs and make noise in that basement. And they were always cool with having us be down there and doing that thing. And I don't know how they did it because, man, having someone just play drums even in the vicinity of you when you're not participating actively in it is enough to make you want to just go jump in front of a bus. So my parents, they're truly a special breed for sure.
How did what he did and does for a living, you know, being in media and being on the news and on TV, in what ways did that occupation influence your early creative pursuits?
I definitely remember as a kid being like, you know, this is such a cool job. Like, maybe this is something that I want to get into and, you know, kind of do that whole legacy thing, which I think a lot of kids get wrapped up in. But I also always had like a really healthy passion for playing music. We took piano lessons and then guitar lessons, and I finally picked up the drums eventually. And I think that they liked that I was doing something just kind of different and unique from two little brothers, and they were, you know, traveling baseball and they were sports obsessed. And I was like, I just want to like play punk rock music on my guitar and go skateboard. And I think that while it was like scary, I think it was also nice just to know that I had these other pursuits that I was passionate about. And I also think that every so often we would like go to the station and watch the news being broadcast. And it's wild to see something happen on TV and then see it in real life and see the production value and like all that goes into it. And I think that certainly like his kind of like nonchalant confidence being on camera and on stage and hosting things and whatever, I think I was impressed by that. And it's something that I aspired to. And, you know, I've always kind of wanted to have like the microphone in my hand and be in control of the music. So I'm thinking that that example may have played a little bit into that as well. Like, he's not necessarily a life of the party, it's all about me guy, but, you know, he's a great storyteller and a really funny and gregarious guy. So I think that that definitely rubbed off on me some too.
That access that he could provide, you know, like you said, we bared witness to some incredible sports moments. And I'm imagining kind of backstage sort of access to a world that, you know, most kids grow up loving, but maybe, you know, maybe only from TV or from the radio,
right.
Or, you know, maybe
a
they get tickets.
Afar.
Yeah. But, yeah. You know, I have no idea what that looked like, if it was like courtside or locker room or what that
right.
was like, but like, that's got to play a role too. And just sort of seeing how these things get made, or like you said, the production value, what goes into the spectacle that most people just watch from the outside.
You know, we weren't at games and stuff because he's on the news. He wasn't a play-by-play guy for any of the teams. But as a reporter, you know, he'd be at different things. And occasionally we would get to tag along and, you know, meet folks. And I remember vividly as a kid, like you said, you know, you see things on TV and you know these guys are tall, but they're all tall. So you don't fully grasp how truly gigantic basketball players
are. There's no point of comparison.
And I remember meeting Horace Grant, you know, at like 8 or 9 years old and just being like, oh my God, he's an actual giant. Like, you know, I think he's like 6'10 or 6'11. And I was just like, this is outrageous. You know, there was a little bit of that, but mostly it was just fun being a fan and then also having someone, you know, a little bit on the inside or a little bit closer to it than most to talk about that sort of stuff. And, you know, especially my little brothers, like they could really chop it up. And I was always like, Cool. <You know? laughs> Sounds good, gang. You know, it's funny. My childhood memories, the deep, like the vivid ones are ultra vivid, and the rest is just like a blur of like t-ball games and riding bikes and going to the pool. it gets murkier and murkier.
You described your folks' reaction, your dad's reaction when you decided to go all in on DJing, but you also described coming up as a musician and punk rock basement band practice and these kinds of things. And so give me the chronology there, the timeline from piano lessons, guitar lessons, ultimately drums.
Sure.
To like the point that I think most people know you for now as a DJ. And
so I started piano when I was in third grade, and I did that through sixth or seventh grade. And by then I was fully invested in alternative rock, and I was desperate for a guitar, and I got this really bottom of the barrel Epiphone for Christmas in eighth grade, and that was it. I started a band with my neighbors down the block, and I played in rock bands through high school, And then in college, like, it became more serious, and I was in a couple of groups that released albums. And I was playing guitar in one and drums in the other. And then basically after college, I'd probably cycled through like 5 or 6 different bands. Do you want the names? Do you want the names of them? Because they're dumb.
I mean, yeah, if you, especially if someone could dig up old audio right. of them.
Oh, you could. It's floating around. The first like big, you know, one that put out an album was called Boy Lion, which I am the guitar player and singer of. So when you hear that voice, it's your boy whining about girls. And then the other one that I played drums in, that was kind of how I got my start playing drums, was called Written in the Sand. And that album stands up. It's pretty great, actually. Very keyboard driven, frenzied indie rock stuff. I played drums in a band called Glam Dan and the Fancy Lads. I was in a garage rock band called The Stare. And pretty much like those last three all broke up around the same time. And I was living with my friend Mike and one of my old bandmates, Chris. And Chris had like a little record collection and a turntable. And it wasn't really until I was like 20, probably 22, that I started to get my first taste of like nightlife and DJ culture. And when I saw the reaction and kind of had that like visceral, like dance party, like sweaty loft party experience, and people got like just, you know, going wild, I was like, man, this is it. Like, what have I been doing with myself? You get to play other people's records and you create the party vibe. And I basically just like figured out how to mix on, you know, one turntable and a crappy Vestax mixer. And I luckily had some friends who were able to put me on, and friends that worked in bars that were like, yeah, you can come play your crappy garbage picked and like dusty bottom bin records at our bar over at Tooman's. And so I probably like really started DJing when I was 23. And then by 25, I think I quit my job and was doing it full time. So it's been like almost 12 years of full time DJing.
Yeah. What kind of music did you start DJing? Was it music that you played of that genre?
It really wasn't. It was like almost wedding DJ-esque, because I really couldn't afford to buy like 12 inches of like hot new stuff, but I could get like dollar records. And so I basically played like a lot of 80s and 90s. And occasionally if like a song came out that I knew I had to have, I would try and find the single. I remember just being obsessed. And still, I think that Beck's Midnight Vultures is just like a start to finish incredible party album. And I had them special order it from Reckless. I was like, I need to play these songs out, which is, you know, again, like a record that had come out probably like 5 years prior to me wanting to play those tunes. But the new hot stuff was few and far between until I really kind of got my weight up and was making enough money DJing to reinvest in a proper record collection, because I didn't grow up collecting records. We didn't really have a turntable at the house when we were kids. I had to kind of get my library sorted out, and I did it like the cheapest way possible. But it also, I think, made me a better DJ, because, you know, when you're playing like old funk and disco records and rock and roll records and trying to mix all that up, especially on vinyl, you really have to put the time into knowing those tunes backwards and forwards, and when to get in and out of the songs, and how to mix live records together where it's not just house music or hip hop, where it's all sequenced nicely for you. So I think it was probably beneficial to my DJing to have started in a way where you really had to be ready to nudge the record up or down a little bit, because those tempos were a little wild when you're playing rock music in the bar.
Yeah. So in these early days, you're getting a chance to play through friends. I'm assuming like not really making money DJing.
No, you know, you'd get like $100 or like $150 cash, especially when you're like a kid. It was just nuts. You know, it was like, oh my God, this is outrageous. And then I literally go spend it all on records. You know, I was still working my normal retail job at Puma. And so I didn't need the money to do anything, but reinvested in my DJ startup. And it eventually, when I first saw, it wasn't even Serato, it was the one before that everyone used. I think it was like Final Scratch or something. I don't know. Doesn't matter. But I believe it was like RJD2 used it at the Puma store, which is like another reason that I got so into it, because we'd have DJs there every weekend and I was like watching and learning and trying to figure out what they were doing. And I was like, wait, this dude is playing MP3s on vinyl. I was like, I'm done buying records. I got to get myself a computer so I can like play records I actually want to play. So I like shut it down for a little bit and saved up all that cash and got my first laptop and made the serious investment in that. And that's when it really started to kind of pop off for me, because I was able to play more current things mixed with, you know, wild left field, old, dumb 90s dance records that I always wanted to play out, stuff from my youth that I remembered loving that I couldn't find on vinyl. And that was when it really got like super fun for me.
I feel like there was an era in Chicago, you know, this is Cool Kids and Kid Sister and
the Floss Boys.
Yeah, Flossstradamus.
And yeah.
It was just like before, like right on the brink, before like MTV was doing little vignettes about some of these kids, and yet they were still super accessible. Like it was,
right.
You know, GL Joe, the whole crew, like Everybody was just making stuff, and Chicago just felt, it was just vibrating.
Like, yeah, like, for sure.
All of these kids were about to break, and this was the soundtrack for like a couple of summers. And I remember being at Tumen's, and you and Emilio, you kind of scored for me a particular time in my life of these kind of, like you described them, like sweaty, slippery floor, tiny little dive bar parties. And I mean, like you screaming into your headphones because you didn't have a mic, and people dancing so hard that like your whole setup would like get unplugged and you'd have to like reboot everything.
The worst. I mean, that was the other reason I had to switch to Serato, because like I just couldn't keep the needles on the records in that place. Like people were bouncing off the walls. It was such a funny, like wild, carefree time. Like the idea that there would be a line down the block to get into Tumen's is laughable. And yet like there was two summers where it was just on and popping in there that we had the best time. And that was like the jumping off point to kind of graduating to the downtown, like club life, bottle service world that I got into after that, which was its own hilarious and wild ride.
Yeah. Speak on that, because somewhere in there, you're gaining enough momentum and confidence and kind of respect, notoriety to leave, you know, a job with some security, you know, like managing retail and having that conversation with your folks, like, I'm going to do this. I've run the numbers. Here's how it's going to work. What had to be true for you to make that transition? Because Tumen's, for anybody who doesn't live in Chicago, or like, it's a little raggedy bar, sort of sits in its own little wasteland. Like there's not a lot of stuff up and around.
No,
Tumen's.
I mean, especially then, you know, there was Darkroom across the street, but it was still like the Ukrainian village, and it was still very much a Chicago neighborhood where a lot of its residents were Polish and Ukrainian people, and they were Polish and Ukrainian businesses. And, you know, I think Ralph Major Taylor started it on Fridays, and then I was the one who came in on Saturdays, and it just became like a spot where you knew you could go and have fun and get after it. And the drinks were cheap and the bartenders were cute, and that's all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. It had a great vibe to it.
It really did. We had a good time down there. But then as far as the bottle service thing goes, you know, Emilio, who we still work together closely, he was already in the nightlife world. Like he had been doing some DJing at Le Passage and had met some of the players in that game. And he was friendly with my friend Molly, who was the bartender over at Tumen's. And he came in one night, you know, stunner shades on, just sat there and like listened to me mix. And at the end of the night, he was like, yo, you're really great. And this was a really fun night. Like, here are three things that you could do to be a better DJ. And I was like, wow, who is this guy? He's unbelievable. And that is like his MO to a T all day, every day. He's telling people what they should be doing to be better at what they do. It's remarkable. He's made enemies that way, but he's also made lifelong friendships. So I appreciate him for the teacher that he is. But between him and Flostradamus catching some heat with some of the downtown club people and Arturo Gomez, formerly of Rocket Ranch, who's still at the helm down at Underground, like they kind of all pulled me towards that downtown club scene and pretty much rode that way for almost like 7 or 8 years also, and experienced all the dumb celebrity nonsense and the late nights and the DJing till 4:30 in the morning and hanging out and coming home when the sun was coming up. And I really didn't drink until I started DJing, and I still didn't really get super loose with it just because I was always wanted to be a professional and actually do my job. You know, you see that with guys kind of getting bombed out, and it's not a good look if that's what you do for a living. Those were some funny days where you just would sleep until noon or one the next day. And as fun as it was, like, I'm so glad that that's not my daily routine, because now I'm up at 6:30 with this little rug rat of mine. And come 10:30, you're like, it's only 10:30. I feel like I accomplished like all the stuff that I needed to accomplish already. It's such a funny, wildly different life than 10 years ago, but it's a good one for sure. It's wild.
How would you characterize the difference between your early days dive bar DJing, teaming up with Emilio, and then La Passage? Like, I don't know how many people know the difference, or like make the distinction for us. Like, how'd you characterize those two environments or those sort of worlds?
I came up in that kind of indie dance party, very DIY, despite the fact that we were playing like dance and hip hop and pop music. It had its kind of own punk rock edge. The party that we did with Floss at Town Hall Pub, like, was just like skater kids and metal dudes and weirdos and art kids, and everyone came together and just like had a blast together. And it had its own just kind of cool energy. You know, it was very DIY. And then the difference is really night and day when you know, get to a Le Passage or an Underground, where it's Function One sound system, the DJ booth is right there on the center of the dance floor. There's lights, there's bottle service girls, there's sparklers. It's big business. It's not about like entertaining your friends. It's about selling bottles and making money. And it's a great way to make a living and be able to do, you know, what I wanted to do, which is just entertain people. But it's a very different way of going about it. There's a lot more personalities, a lot more, you know, kind of bumps along the road that you have to navigate, because so-and-so, it's their birthday and they just spent, you know, $2,000. And if they don't hear the Superman theme song, they're going to lose their minds. So it's a very different sort of place to try to be creative, because you're really catering to the customer in a way that was different than being at Tumens or at Town Hall Pub or any of the indie dance party stuff that we used to do, where we were trying to play new records and play interesting stuff and make weird mashups. It's just a different creative space. The difference between playing to 100 of your friends versus 500 paying customers, like, you make more inroads into the sort of thing that I've been doing now, which is like a little bit more like corporate and private event work. Like, those people that were there 7, 8, 9 years ago, like, they still are around, and now they own businesses and they want me to be a part of those things because they remember the fun that we had in those clubs, and they want to have that same sort of experience for what they're planning for their businesses or their meetings or what have you. So it's like everyone's kind of grown up along the way. And I think a lot of the same players are still, while they've graduated to new things, they're still looking for people that were in that kind of peer group then to lean on them to get things done nowadays.
How much of that transition was you just sort of maturing, growing up, saying like, oh, here's the trajectory I see for myself? Or survival. Yo, I can't live off of these parties. Like, I need to do something else. Like, this is awesome. But because I felt like there was a point where I was like, well, where are all the dance party magic events, you know? And, people were like, oh, you haven't heard? Matt doesn't do that anymore. And having a title that shifted from DJ to music director or some of these other titles you had where it's like,
right,
you know, I'm creating a lifestyle or a scene at this upscale nightlife spot. And yeah, talk about that shift.
All this was happening during the kind of like celebrity DJ come up. And I think that a lot of us who were there during that time and were starting to like see our friends travel, you know, internationally, and the Bloghouse thing like becoming such a big musical takeover, and seeing people, you know, get like a remix on Disco Bell, and next thing you know, they're like flying across the country to play cool parties in Vancouver or Miami or wherever. That seemed like the next logical step. And for whatever reason, I think that we felt like we could take that step further in the super club world than we could in the indie dance world. And that whole DIY thing is real. It's like, you know, we were working with you to make t-shirts. We were designing our own flyers. We're promoting our own parties. And after, you know, years and years of that, it's like, man, it's pretty tight to get paid, you know, twice as much to show up and do what you're really good at. I think that some of it certainly was just, you know, trying to graduate to the next level of financial stability, but also trying to get on that kind of like celebrity traveling DJ level, where we were seeing some of our friends really start to like kill it. And it seemed like such a fun, wild lifestyle to be a part of. We did a little bit of that. You know, we'd fly around and did some of the traveling thing. But for whatever reason, I think we started standing up DJ programs here in Chicago too. We worked really closely with the Melmans and the Let Us Entertain You venues, as like the brothers were starting to take over the reins from Rich. We got really busy locally, also trying to like put DJs on and make clients happy. And so the business started kicking in even more so than the celebrity DJ stuff. And that was great because we were not only making money doing something that we loved doing, but then we were also helping our friends make money and get on. And there was probably like 3, 4, 5 years there where we were booking like 20 different DJs in a given night, and everybody was getting paid. And it was like a really exciting time to be building this business. What we were trying to do is like have a little agency, help people get on and make money. And it was all on and popping for like a good long while. And then like any industry, people figure out who the players are. And all of a sudden they're like, we got this. And they're just like, we don't need you to do this anymore. Thank you for, you know, paving the way and introducing us to the players. But like, now we're good. So, you know, kind of end up going back to the drawing board of what's the next thing? Like, what's the next way that we're going to be able to continue to do what we do well and make a living at it.
This is the Crossfader King. I don't know, what would you call it? Collective? Company? Agency?
It always was trying to be an agency, but we never signed artists. We were more like a DJ source for people who knew they needed a good DJ, and we had the guys to do the job, and we would help source the talent. They weren't signed like an artist, but they were all Crossfader King adjacent DJs who we would try to, you know, put on and put in the best position to make money and go rock a party.
Yeah, you kind of maintained a roster of talent.
Exactly. That's another thing that I feel like Emilio was really on early. And, you know, there's a bunch of little collectives now, and that I think that Emilio definitely was kind of there early and maybe even first here in Chicago, and inspired a lot of people to be like, oh, that's like something we can do too. He's at the forefront of a lot of things around here. I don't think he gets the credit he deserves necessarily. Shout out to E6, the Crossfader King himself.
I love that dude. I don't see him much, but when I do, I'm always really, really grateful for the encounter. He's always got like 6 new schemes and like fresh ideas he's pursuing. And yeah, he's always on some next shit.
He really is. It's wild. We were rapping about trying to get back in the club a little bit more regularly. And he's like, I can't wear sunglasses in the club anymore. It's like, so I'm wearing a cowboy hat. He's like, I'm just trying to be like as audacious as possible. I'm just like, I love this guy. He's out of control.
You know, you're DJing, you're playing other people's music. You're starting to kind of graduate into this upper echelon of, I'll say like higher society sort of nightlife and social life and celebrity and the scene. And at the same time, are you still recording as a musician, as a drummer, and during all this?
I was still playing in bands in 2010, which is insane. I joined the 1900s, and they put out a really beautiful album, and we toured on that a little bit and played a show over in the UK. And it was one of those things where I joined the band in their 4th release. And by then, you know, everyone's older, everyone's wearier of the road thing. People have got responsibilities and jobs and lives, and we were never able to really fully realize, I think, the potential of that album and touring on it, just because the older you get, the more things you got to kind of deal with personally. I also was playing drums in a band called Innkeepers that has an EP that we're still trying to get released, you know, like 3 years later, because again, all those guys have kids and jobs and lives. And I miss playing drums more regularly. You know, we bought a little house over here in Logan Square, like Avondale area, and we just kind of semi-finished the basement, and my drum set is set up in this basement, and I've been playing them. And it's been like the joy of joys to be able to just like come downstairs and play. I'm really hoping that the 1900s recorded a little 5 or 6 song EP maybe a year ago, and it's in the process of getting mixed up and shaped up. So we're hoping that maybe we could play some shows together this summer and get that released. But I've been trying to wrap my mind around the whole production thing as well. And I have a handful of, you know, little remixes and edits and stuff that I'm proud of, but it's such a different animal. And the learning curve is so steep with making dance music that is sonically good enough to actually want to play on a real sound system, that it's been a challenge. Like it's a difficult thing to do, especially now on my own business. I work with Emilio doing Crossfader King stuff. I'm a dad, I'm a homeowner. You're pulled in all these different directions. And it's not like when you're 20 years old and you've got 8 hours to figure out how to like compress a snare. Like I don't have 8 hours to learn how to compress a snare drum, man. Like that is not the reality of my situation. So I'm excited at the prospect of doing some more things with live music, just now that my basement and desk and studio setup are back up and running. Hopefully get back into that world as well and try and start putting out some mixes and some edits and some remixes and get back on that production train.
That's great, man. I'm looking forward to that. That's good to hear.
Yeah, it's time. Got a new little MIDI keyboard and got the studio monitors put back together and the turntable setup put back together. So it's now finally getting back into the swing of trying to just open up Ableton and make noise, even if it's just nonsense, just to get reacclimated to the process.
Yeah, I was just talking to Creighton Berman, and we were talking about how important it is to have your tools at the ready, not having to dig out something and clear a desk off and set it up. And then that same desk is the desk that you're going to eat your dinner on. And so you got to like pack that up and move it out of the way. And like,
it's a slog. Like it is truly a hindrance to production. You're describing my situation. It was like, I was just working from the, you know, our dining room table for like the last 7 months. It's not really great for making music.
Yeah. And you know, when an idea strikes or you're inspired to say like, okay, cool, I need 45 minutes to set my shit back up to do that, like the feeling just goes away. You're like, yeah, no, I'm not even going to bother. And what a privilege or a blessing it is when you have another space or an extra space or a practice space or just something where all that making stuff can just sit out in the open and you have no barriers to just jumping in and trying to realize, you know, some of these ideas or visions you have.
Having grown up in an awesome house where my parents let us be as loud as humanly possible with band practice, like it was like a lifelong dream of mine to have a basement where I could do that, especially with my daughter. Like, you know, she'll come down here and she only has the attention to play the drums for maybe 45 seconds before she runs off to the next thing. But just to like have a place to be loud and play music and play guitar and yell on the microphone together has been so much fun. It's like, we feel like we have a whole new house, you know, we have like a whole new space where we can come be wild. And it is beyond special. Like I really get how lucky I am to have figured this out well enough, you know, at least to hang on to this house for as long as I can afford to hang on to it.
Yeah.
My wife and I are really lucky that we both own our own businesses, and we've by and large been able to get away with being around for these first 3.5+ years. And we didn't have to do like the daycare thing. My wife's a makeup artist and she's really busy on the weekends and I'm really busy on the weekends. So we've had a lot of family support and letting, you know, grandma and grandpa taking great care of her when we can't do it. Yeah, we really got away with it, that we were able to kind of work our schedules around to be here.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of taking this other path, you know, owning your own business as the two of you and having them both be in large part creative endeavors, right? Whether that's, you know, being a makeup artist or being a, you know, a musician and a DJ. These are things that I think from the outside, people wonder, can you live on that? Like,
right.
And then to say, you can buy a house on that?
Right.
And then to say, like, you can actually raise a human and take care of a baby on like, you know, those two occupations. And from the outside looking in, I think people are probably puzzled. Like, yeah, but what else do you do? Like, surely you do something right. else, you know, to make ends meet or whatever. And it's important for people to see all the ways in which parents, families can be structured to do that. And the trade-offs that are made, like you now running your own business have the flexibility to schedule your work around your life rather than, you know, the other way around. And
yeah, for sure. I take her to school every day. I pick her up most often in the afternoon, and it's a joy. Like, it's rough on Saturdays. Like, you know, this Friday I'll be at disco until 3:30 in the morning, and my wife is leaving for work at like 7. So I'll probably sleep from like 4 to 6:30 or 7, and then I'll just be up for the rest of the day. And that is how my Saturdays are.
Do us all a favor and don't drive anywhere.
Yeah, I know, right?
On 2 hours of sleep.
We'll be walking.
We'll be crawling.
We'll be walking to coffee and then figure out what goes on after that. But if that's the hardest part of the scheduling that I'm able to like be around and be in the mix, like I volunteer, like I do lunch at her school every other week. I go to all the art projects. Like, it's so fun, especially to see her in this wild classroom element where it's Montessori. So it's like 4 and 5 year olds. And it's kind of just, you know, organized chaos, and getting to see her interact with other kids and how it all works. It has given me so much appreciation for teachers and educators. It's another one of those things. It's like, oh boy, like the DJ thing, I can do that. Like, I can give you all of my energy for like 3 or 4 hours and try to entertain you as much as possible. But the idea of like giving all of your energy to like 30 preschoolers for 8 hours a day is unfathomable to me. It really takes a special somebody to do that. We got to pay these people like 10 times more than they're making.
No kidding. No doubt. Yeah, let's get into it, man. Describe your situation, what you were up to when you found out you were having a kid. What was it like?
It was kind of like getting the wind knocked out of you in a way. Like, my wife really like was sneaky and cute with it. Our old apartment, we had like this back bedroom that she kind of uses like her studio. And she was like, so, you know, I was thinking we got to get this closet in here and this and that, but like, I can't figure out where we're going to put the crib. Just like real casually tossed it out like that. I was like, oh yeah, the crib. I was like, are you serious? Are you serious? Are you serious? And I just like repeated, are you serious, for like 3 minutes. And then of course gave her a huge hug. Like, we were so excited. And then you're like, oh man, like it's a wrap, you know, like this is the start of something totally new and it's never going to end. And I think I was up like all night that night, just thinking about what I was going to do, make this all work. And then somehow, like literally like 48 hours later, it was like, we're having a baby, like tight, let's get into it. You know, like I needed to get over the initial like shock and horror of having to like be responsible for someone other than myself. And then I was like, you know what? We've always said we were going to do this. Now is as good a time as any. Like, you know, there's no good time to have a baby, especially when you're working for yourself and you got to be around when the money's there to be made.
I'm shocked it only took you 48 hours, man.
It really was really scary that whole first night. And I was just like, had all this nervous energy. And then I was just like, you know, we can do fine for ourselves. Like, our parents raised 3 boys. Her parents raised 4 children. We can take care of a baby. Like, our schedules are flexible. Like, we can definitely do this. And so far, so good. You know, knock on this IKEA desk, that it all keeps going smoothly.
Yeah. What went through your mind with regards to work specifically and the kind of work that you do and things that you maybe before she said, hey, you know, where do we put the crib? You know, like plans that you had or, okay, so this is the direction I want to take the business. Like, tell me how those things went, like that collision.
I fully understand that, like, I probably won't be 60 in DJing. It'd be super tight if I was, but it's probably not my reality. And there was certainly that, like, all right, we have to create something that is going to last now. And it's time to start thinking, like, more seriously about the business side of this world and how we're going to create longevity. And I'm started thinking about my wife's business and how we can make that like even bigger and better than it is. And she's been like crushing and is so talented. And luckily, like she's really able to help carry the weight of our partnership, not just with her financially, but with her time and energy also. And there was definitely that kind of like, this is going to be my responsibility moving forward. Like, how am I going to provide stability for all of us moving forward? So that was probably the scariest thought. And I've been lucky to have had such incredible support and such cool folks that I've worked with that regularly have me back and do events and big production companies and stuff that I've really been trying to take great care of those relationships and think harder about building other lasting relationships, because I really feel like at the end of the day, like you could be like the dopest DJ in the world, but if you aren't thankful and appreciative and a good business person and conscientious about what you're doing, like it really doesn't matter. It's all about making people's decisions easy. And so that's one of the things that I'm focusing on, is really trying to like be the best option for people. And then also getting back in the club and getting back on the production side of things, like especially in this day and age, like everyone's a DJ. So you really have to continue to like make your presence felt. And so I'm trying to get back into that mode too. Self-promotion has never been something that I've been good at, and I genuinely dislike it. But I realize like we have so many successful friends who are successful because they're like, I'm dope. Like, look at me. I'm doing dope stuff all the time. And like, that's part of it too. So I've been trying to get over that ickiness of being like, hey, check out all this cool stuff I do. It's like, you know what? That's part of this. Like, you better just figure it out and do it. Other than that, I'm still wrapping my brain around kind of what's next, because again, like I'm not an old person, but I'm not young. And I get that there's going to be a shelf life on all of this.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I like, people will talk about design being sort of a young person's game, especially as technology and certain digital workflows and the kind of like products that people make, like it skews young. And I feel like there's just a belief or a perception that it's the hot, fresh, young talent coming in that really moves the design industry forward. But there's design legends that are, they're into their 70s, they're into their 80s, and you know, they're the people you point to say like, yeah, one day I want to be like him or her and have this studio or whatever. And I've never really thought how, you know, like if you're an author, you can write books late into your game. But for DJing, I don't know any DJs in their 60s or 70s, you know? And
that is a thing that does not occur. That said, you know, I'm sure like Tiesto's pushing 50, you know, like these big deal producers who they make all their money doing the festival thing.
Sure, I think like Paul Oakenfold and some of these guys that are...
Right. Some of these guys are older, but like they are also legends. They've made huge fan bases over decades long careers. It's a very different thing to be a working DJ and figure out what the longevity of that is and just how to maximize all of it. There's a lot that DJing is like tied into that I think would make a cool transition, but I'm also trying to like, you know, find a way to really like see this thing through, because it's what I love to do, what I'm really good at. And so far my years have been getting like better and better over the last 2 or 3 years. So I think that I'm a little bit in my own head about getting old. It's like people love who they love and they trust who they trust. And if you can maintain those relationships, like there's no reason for that to go away, you know? Mm-hmm.
You touched on another interesting dynamic in that it sounds like your wife and her business makes more money than you do in yours?
Not yet, but I'm working on it. I would love for that to happen. And I feel like it's inevitable. She's like basically designing a website so that all of her scheduling and emails and like everything gets like super automated. Nothing really falls in the cracks. And she's taken on like two new artists and kind of growing her own little like branded makeup agency. And I really feel like the sky's the limit for her. She's wildly talented. I could see product lines. I could see master classes. Like, she's that good at it. And I think that if one day all of a sudden DJ Matt Rohn is just like not cool at all, like, I think that Shannon O'Brien is going to carry the torch for us for years to come. So we are always sitting at the table, like figuring out how we can best help one another. And we're lucky that she's really heavy in the wedding industry. And that's actually something that I've gotten deeper into over the last few years. And we try to make sure that we're always putting each other forward for gigs and talking about each other with clients and people, because our business is really like a lot of artistic endeavors. Like, it's very referral heavy.
You mentioned you know, your daughter goofing around on the drums with you in the basement. What role does she play in your own creative endeavors?
She has certainly made me like pick the guitar back up. We play music at the house all of the time. And she's so our child. She's just like a show kid. She just like loves to put on a show. She is very dramatic, constantly singing, constantly dancing. And I think that having music around her all the time is part of that. But I also just think it's like innately in her to move. You know, having her around, it's been so fun to like just pick up the guitar and like make up songs with her, which is something that I wouldn't have done on my own. I think like playing instruments has definitely been a bigger part of my day as a result. And it's so nice just to like feel, you know, inspired to do that. Even if it's just, you know, making up dumb nonsense, at least we're doing something creative and fun together.
Tell me about the baby raves.
Oh boy. So yeah, that's another funny facet of what I've been up to lately. The baby rave is just like a clever way to market like a dance party for families. This dude, Mr. Dave, who's like his own little celebrity in the child entertainment world. I grew up with his wife, and they have a cool little space in Ricker Park. And they were really excited about trying to introduce this like baby DJ programming into their space. And I just like don't really have the bandwidth to do that. And I was kind of telling them, like, you know, I don't know what that curriculum would look like. I'm not super excited about having children like destroy expensive music equipment. You know, like, it just, I couldn't really wrap my mind around what that would look like. But I would 100% throw parties with you guys and find a way to entertain the parents and the kids. And they're like, yeah, let's do that. That's another thing we could do. So
because it's a kid's music school, right? Or it's like a hands-on, like explore instruments and music.
Exactly. Like, you know, he does a lot of like singing, performing, and then the kids get scarves out and the drums out and the shakers, and everyone clap to the beat. They do the moves and sensory learning and musical driven entertainment, but it's also has its own educational component. Our thing is like almost more for the parents to feel like they have a little bit of normalcy in their lives, and then they can like go have a beer and let their kids run wild and hear music that they like and have a family thing that is not so baby focused. It's like actually fun for them. So we've been doing them for the last couple of years. We've done quite a few at Chop Shop. We just did this wild thing at Macy's a couple of weeks ago, lights and glow sticks and the whole thing. And I play family friendly pop and dance stuff and yell on the microphone for the kids to roar like their favorite animal or jump like a kangaroo or whatever. And like, it's like been very organic and natural because it's a sort of nonsense that I would do at home with my own daughter. So it's really been another one of these, wow, like I thought I was going to be a celebrity DJ. Instead, I'm DJing for toddlers and their parents at 10 o'clock in the morning at Macy's. But I am still doing what I like to do and entertaining people. And it's so different from that like super club world. But at the same time, it's like the end result is the same. It's like you're responsible for everyone's good time. People leave with a smile on their face. Ideally, they had a blast. And like they go about their day, and their kids ideally like nap harder than they would have had they, you know, been staring at the TV all morning. So It's a really funny endeavor, but I've really enjoyed watching it grow. You know, we like sell the things out, like hundreds of people come. It's the sort of thing that I could never do. You know, I'm not getting 100 people to come to the club. Like, there's a million clubs, or there's only one baby rave and all the parents are there with their kids. It's so wild.
I'm imagining a bunch of these parents came up listening to you.
Oh, 100%. Like, we're all at that age where like a lot of them have kids and they're like, oh, remember like when you would like get me on the list for Underground? Now I'm asking to be on the list for the baby rave. How dumb is all of this? I'm like, yeah, it's real dumb. We're grownups now. Check it out.
I love it. It's awesome.
It's wild.
Do you think at all about, I don't know, like the impact of doing a super family friendly daytime event on, you know, your personal brand as Matt Rohn? Nightlife DJ, or,
you know, I think about it, but like at the end of the day, that's like true to who I am. I'm not a spray champagne on girls party boy. I'm a dad who loves music and who's made a name for myself as a DJ. And I'm getting to like share that with really wildly different audiences from even from day to day, you know, week to week. Like tonight, I'm DJing the Joffrey Ballet Gala. And certainly there'll be a lot of 7-year-olds there that I'll be playing dance music for. And then I'm going to disco to close, and there'll be a bunch of young people there who are going to be out of their minds and drunk and wild. And that's what makes this so much fun. It's like every day it's a different challenge, and you kind of have to pick your records and figure out how you're going to entertain everybody. And it's the same thing at the baby rave. It's like, where am I going to play Baby Shark? And how am I going to make everybody like laugh at this? Because we all, like all the parents get it. Like, this is hilarious. And also, if it's great, it's great. It really doesn't matter necessarily who the audience is, you know, like if it's fun for everybody, they're going to remember that. And, you know, maybe I end up DJing their corporate event, or I end up DJing someone's private 40th birthday party, or I like being there and showing up and doing a great job. Like, it's like always worth it. And I don't care enough to act like I'm some cool guy who can't do things that would entertain my daughter. That's not how I operate.
It feels like you're fully embracing the fact that you are a killer nightlife DJ and a dad, and that those can coexist.
Absolutely. I really think that it's something to be celebrated. It's not easily done. And it's something that people should be excited about, that you're able to pull all this off, to hide it or act like it's not a big part of your world seems so disingenuous. It's like, no, man, like I spend a lot of time with that kid, and to act like I don't would just be odd to me. Plus, she's like so funny and hilarious. I mean, at this stage of the game, I think that most people follow me on Instagram for like her shenanigans. And like, if a club fire shows up, they're like, cool, but more child content, please. Like, she is nuts. That is my life now. And, you know, I'm going to be honest about it.
You mentioned Baby Shark making its way into the mix. And I'm curious, as someone who makes music and plays other people's music, and is, I guess, as a DJ, like, how do you feel about, there's so much garbage kids music out there. There's so much awful, unlistenable, dreadful shit. And like, weirdly, kids don't have a filter, you know, they let a lot of things through and are entertained by all kinds of things that anyone with just a little bit of taste is like, I can't, you know, like,
right, this is not for me.
Yeah. And so what's the music like at home, or how, you know, have you found artists that work for her and you?
Yeah. You know, I think that like, she loves to dance. And so when I play like house and dance music here at the house, it usually goes over. If it has a beat, she's usually down for it. That's kind of where I like to be DJ wise. So listening to dance stuff at the house, like it's a hit for everybody. If it's disco or house or dance, like she can usually ride with it.
Yeah. I was talking with Jesse Hora on the show, and we both came up listening to a lot of hip hop and still do, but have found it in, you know, he's got a daughter. I now have a daughter too. And we were both remarking at how, like, having a kid, and especially a girl, all of a sudden I'm just,
you're listening to the lyrics.
Yeah. And I'm like, wow, this is some of the, this is the most sexist, hateful, misogynistic shit ever. And I don't listen to, you know, I don't listen to garbage rap. I mean, I, even rappers I consider, you know, classic or golden era, or, you know, boom bap or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Even then I'm just like, ugh, weird. I never heard this before. I'm kind of ashamed. I never noticed. And like, obviously I was all right. I permitted this for, you know, decades, you know, and
in my life it was, yeah, this was like go-to material. Yeah,
and now like, there's no fucking way I would play that stuff, you know, like, and I'm also now like grossed out by it, or I feel like, man, these, some of these rappers need to have daughters themselves. Cause I bet they would not keep churning this stuff out if they did. Cause it's like, it serves no one. Like, it just perpetuates really gross shit. And I'm struck by how much I permitted.
Right. You like digested all this stuff for all these years without really.
Yeah. And I'm sure it affected me. I'm sure in like little ways it's crept into the, you know, the way that I think about the world. And it just kind of bummed me out. And I was like, wow, this is just gross. And I, whatever, like she may come up and listen to the most gutter, you know, rap music ever. And, you know, and not care at all. Or, you know, my son might do the same and they'll be that whole time when it's like, well, you listen to that. You're right. You
know, like, yeah. Oh yeah. We'll have those fights. I'm sure.
I'm so conscious of it in a way I wasn't before I was a dad. Did anything like that occur for you?
Absolutely. Just the way that the world is and the Me Too movement. And I've been similarly shocked by some of the behavior and content and things that you read about people that you imagine being decent people and they're simply not. I really don't play a ton of hip hop at the house. I still have to have all that stuff at the ready for work, but it's not what I'm spending my listening time on. We just play kind of like classic, like disco and house music around the house because she's not going to hear any words she shouldn't be hearing or repeating. And it's just like easier on everybody. But even turning on the radio, sometimes you're just like, man.
Are you intentional about your daughter's creativity or creative opportunities?
You know, we try to like limit TV and just make sure that she always has like creative tools at the ready. Like there's a big box of instruments. The paint set is always out. The crayons are always available. Like there's a little bin of like dress up stuff. She has access to the arts whenever she is ready to pursue them. But I really don't try to force her in anything because even at a young age, I feel like that's when things get not fun. So I want her to kind of like find things at her own pace. I'd love for her to sit down and just like get hella into the drums and become like a ripper. But if that's not what she wants to do, then so be it. Like, I'm not going to force it because there's so much joy in music, and to force it on somebody takes the joy out of it. And I don't want that for her. So I've been trying to just be cool about letting her, you know, come to things in her own time.
I mean, similarly, like we just said, having all your equipment at the ready means you can just get to it and making sure that she's got all of her version of that within arm's reach means there's no barrier to being creative or making something or playing in those ways. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I feel like that's all you can really do.
I'm curious if you have any specific tactical strategies for preserving creative time or protecting creative time. Do you still practice DJing? Do you like, what does that look like?
It's something that had by and large like disappeared when she was born, really through her starting school. You know, I would find time to do my creative work. Yeah, I owe a mix to somebody or I owe a remix to someone, or I would put those hours on the calendar. But being creative for creative's sake was a total challenge. Like it just really didn't factor into my thought process. It was more about let's keep this baby alive. Let's keep paying our bills and making sure that we also are like well rested enough and get to spend some quality time with one another. All that stuff trickles down into whatever your creative endeavors are. Like if you're just pissed or exhausted, nothing really good's going to come out of that. So until she started school, it was me and her a lot. I would say from like 1 year to 3 years, I spent a lot of time with her. And when she would nap, I would try and squeeze in emails, you know, like you just are trying to kind of like keep your head above water, just even on the admin side of things. So the idea of being able to just like, today I'm going to write a song was just like Yeah, right, dude. That is not what you're going to be doing today. You have dishes to do. You have like a house to clean. Like, I really have become a very domestic human being. And basically, like the last 3.5 years, like the creativity part has been just squeezed into things here and there. It's really been more about like keeping everyone happy and healthy and keeping the business up and running. And now that these drums are set up and the guitar amp is plugged in and the turntables are put back together, I'm like finally starting to get back in the swing of doing things. Just yesterday, I was downloading records for a 90s night that's coming up and thinking about wordplay and blends and things that I could be doing that night to like set my set apart. So it's nice to feel that that is starting to come back to a little bit bigger part of my day.
I've personally felt, you know, frustration or defensiveness or resentment over the years as I've had to put creative activities or practices or just the routine of making on pause, on hold. And so, you know, it's awesome that it's coming back. But while things were down, like, how would you characterize your emotions during that time? Tell me about that.
My main source of frustration, I think, was that I was putting in a lot of time to making the family go. That's everything from just like making dinner to cleaning the house to whatever, and really trying to like keep everything moving forward and keep everybody happy. And then also on top of that, like DJing 3 nights a week and, you know, trying to earn money and pay bills and stay on top of business. I felt like at certain points, it was more like the creative want wasn't even like as big a deal as just like, you know, you lose so much of your autonomy, especially when you have like a little infant or like a really small child, because you're at the beck and call like 24 hours a day because they can't do anything for themselves. So the idea of like trying to do it all was at times frustrating. But I think I'm a generally positive dude. And whenever I was getting like extra salty about things, I would just find a way to either go skate or go play music, you know, do those things that is just for me. And while that was kind of like few and far between, I think that it certainly helped. And Shannon totally gets that and has been really supportive. I feel like I was really selfless with my time during those stretches. But at the same time, like whenever I asked for time, I would get it. So it came more down to like managing time and expectations. And like I said, like at times it was frustrating to feel like there was never any downtime. It felt like it was always, like there was always something going on, always something to do and some problem to solve or what have you. You couldn't just like be relaxed for a minute. But at the end of the day, it's like, those are the things that you need to do to have 2 people run successful businesses and keep a baby alive. So like, suck it up, you know, like we don't have any other options. So put your head down and do it. It worked, you know, like it's all positive. And our businesses have grown over the last few years, despite the fact that, you know, we have a small child at home that we have to take care of. So it's like, it's all trending in the right direction. So I try to just like be thankful and grateful for all the good things that have come our way. And all the like wild support from our families and taking her when we need some help or some backup and just chalking it up. It's like, this is part of being an entrepreneur and part of being a parent, and you just have to deal with it.
And what is that kind of collaborative effort or negotiation, you know, these sort of trade-offs that you're making where you say, and thankfully, you know, when I needed time, I could ask for it. And for the most part, I got it. Any tips, any strategies for like how that gets negotiated between mom and dad?
The two of us really don't fight because it's not how either of us like to express ourselves. Like Shannon, especially, like she really shuts it down instead of letting it out. Like at my house growing up, it was like, if you guys are mad at each other, like it's kind of like family meeting time. We're going to get to the bottom of this. I'm more prone to trying to like have as meaningful a conversation about conflict as I can. And I think that being able to clearly communicate and express your feelings, making it about like what's going on with you versus what the other party is doing that's like making your life so difficult, that's the key to me. I felt like we were good about just being like, this is what's going on. this is where I'm at. I need to get A, B, C, and D done by the end of the week. Like, let's schedule time so that these things can get accomplished. And we are both big fans of one another and champions of each other's businesses. None of this really goes without the other one. So being like resentful or being bent out of shape about things, even if it's like a real emotion, it's one that is not going to benefit anybody in the long run. We're a team and a package deal, and we have to like support each other no matter what. I think that we get that. And even if there's like some frustration or funky times, we also get that we really lean on one another. So it's really just about trying to be honest with each other and yourself about your needs. Like, that's all you can do. Like, emotions are real and feelings are real. And you just have to be like, I see you, I hear you. Now let's tackle this and move forward.
And do you think you could have the same understanding if Shannon wasn't also an entrepreneur and an artist, you know, in her own right? I feel like what you just described, like the fact that you're both those things, make it, in my mind, like more possible. Like, I know what it takes to get this thing done. I know that you've got to do these things to realize, you know, this vision or this idea.
I think that it certainly goes a long way. I think that if one of us had a proper 9-to-5, it would definitely be a very different situation. But also, like, we'd have health insurance, you know, like we'd have other mechanisms in our lives that would be taking some of the burden of being entrepreneurs off of us. So it's like, maybe you don't have to hustle as hard because you don't owe $800 a month in health insurance premiums. So there's always like a give and a take as far as that stuff goes. But I definitely agree with you in that because we're both living a very similar business life and creative life, if emails need to get done, then someone's going to put that kid to bed and make dinner, and the emails are going to get taken care of, or the mix is going to get made, or the playlist is going to get created. And that is how we operate, because we both understand that great service is 90% of the business part of things. Getting back to people on time and taking care of what needs getting taken care of. That's kind of like how you win. And so we try and help each other do that.
Yeah. I got one last question for you, Matt. Being a DJ and musician, does that make you a better or worse dad?
I would like to think it makes me a better dad. I am a somewhat emotional person by nature, and I've always been like a touchy-feely human being. But since having a child, I'm just like, I could just like cry at the drop of a hat. It's it's wild. And I think that being involved in music and the arts is like being in touch with your emotions. And I think that being someone who can relate to your child or talk to your child about what they're feeling, maybe you go stomp that out, or maybe you go play the drums really loud and get that out of your system. We're just like, if this is what you need to go do, like, you can go do it at the drum set, or you can go do it in your room, go jump hard until it's done. And so I'd like to think that being a emotional person who's kind of like in touch with that side of them, like, that's all enriched by music. And I think that it's definitely like made me be able to feel things more deeply. The kids' feelings are real too, even if they seem insane.
Yeah, no doubt. Matt, thanks so much. This has been awesome. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's been a pleasure, man. It was nice catching up with you for sure. And I'm excited to hear what some of these other guys got to say about things. See if I can learn a trick or two to keep us all alive over here.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a quick review on iTunes. As a first season podcast, this helps a ton, and it would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of them. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter and even cop some fresh Dadwell merch. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks again for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.